Case for argument this morning is Kay against Milwaukee.
Please, the court.
Ms. Eikenberry.
My name is Shauna Eikenberry, and I'm here today as amicus, appointed by this court to represent the interests of plaintiff and appellant Joseph K. While the amicus brief addressed a number of issues, I would like to focus my discussion here today on the district court's decision to impose sanctions on Mr. K, and specifically on its decision to impose monetary sanctions and order Mr. K to pay defendant's attorney's fees.
Has anything happened in the district court to quantify the amount of attorney's fees since the briefs were filed?
I believe that affidavits and declarations have been filed as to the amount of the attorney's fees. I don't believe the district court has ruled as to those amounts. Time permits, at the end, I will address the first issue raised in the amicus brief concerning whether the district court's decision was sufficiently final to give this court jurisdiction over this appeal. The district court's order
actually, jurisdiction comes first, as you know. But I'm the district court had done something that would help with the jurisdictional problem. The other part of the jurisdictional problem, whether this was termination of the lawsuit or the dismissal of the complaint, I understand you're in a complicated position because you're appearing as an amicus curiae rather than as counsel for Mr. K. But has anything in your preparation of this case given you any insight into whether Mr. K wants to replead?
Reviewing his briefs that have been filed in this court, that is one of the requests for relief that he's requested from this court, is for remand and allowance to replead.
He didn't request below, though, to replead.
No, he did not. The district court's order granted the defendant's motion for sanctions despite the fact that Mr. K's complaint, while possibly technically deficient, could have been corrected to state a claim if amended. And, in fact, the court made absolutely no finding that amendment would be futile or otherwise should not be allowed. This decision was an error and should be reversed. Sanctions are, of course, reserved for situations where there has been a callous disregard for governing law or the procedures of the court. Sanctions are not appropriate simply because an argument fails. They're not appropriate simply because plaintiff has a weak argument. Instead, and particularly as in this case when there's no specific finding of dilatory motive or bad faith, sanctions should be imposed only for frivolous claims that have no legal basis. The district court's reasoning behind awarding sanctions was limited to one paragraph at the end of its decision in which it stated Mr. K should have known that the allegations in his complaint failed to state a claim. But the court's finding in this regard was based solely on Mr. K's deficiencies in his complaint, and the district court made absolutely no finding that those deficiencies could not be corrected. They made no finding that amendment would be futile. They made no finding of any dilatory motive. In a situation such as this, sanctioning a plaintiff and requiring him to pay attorney's fees, even though there was no finding that he could have no legal claim, goes too far and should be reversed. A RICO claim requires a plaintiff to show conduct of an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. Even if Mr. K's complaint falls short of meeting all of the elements of a RICO claim, which is a difficult task to do, his pleading deficiencies are not what Rule 11 was intended for. The standard for dismissing a claim under Rule 12b-6 is obviously different than the standard for imposing sanctions under Rule 11, or else every plaintiff who had their complaint dismissed would be risking sanctions. That's clearly not the intent of either one of the rules. In reviewing Mr. K's complaint, it shows that he did, in fact, come close to pleading a valid RICO claim. And the district court, in making its decision, ignored some of the allegations in the complaint in finding that the complaint should be dismissed. For example, the district court found that Mr. K should have known that theft was not a predicate act under RICO. And the district court's finding with regard to that was in relation to the taking of the yard sign. What the district court ignored was the Wisconsin extortion statute, which does qualify as a predicate act under RICO, and the taking of the yard sign and the allegations relating to blacklisting can, in fact, state a claim under Wisconsin extortion law, which, in relevant part, states that anyone who threatens an injury to a person's property, business, or profession with the intent to compel the person not to do any lawful act constitutes extortion. The district court did not address that in its decision. And even if not artfully pled, the facts in Mr. Cade's complaint do, in fact, support a potential claim under that law. The allegations concerning the EVA election fraud, the district court found that Mr. K had failed to plead fraud with specificity. In making that finding, the district court focused on the actual wire communication stating that Mr. K failed to plead the who, what, when, and where of that wire communication. The district court overlooked the fact that it was not the actual wire communication that Mr. K was alleging to be the fraud. The wire communication is what perpetrated the overall fraud, which involved the election scheme. The district court also, in sanctioning Mr. K, found that he should have known that he did not plead a pattern of racketeering activity. It should be noted that the district court's decision in this regard ignored what I just discussed, which was the allegations of Wisconsin extortion law and the allegations relating to the wire fraud. Instead, it's finding that he did not meet the pleading of a pattern was based solely on its finding that the only acts it could consider were the alleged acts of bribery. In this case, despite what the defendants have argued, this case is not exactly like Gamboa or Rogers. Gamboa involved a clear, closed-end one scheme to set up the plaintiff for murder. The court found that's one scheme. There are no allegations reflecting that that scheme is going to continue or that there's a possibility of an ongoing continuity. This case is different. Mr. K has made allegations that show that he might be able to prove at trial. Again, this is a 12B6. He doesn't have to prove his case. He has made allegations that show there could be an ongoing pattern. Likewise, in Roger, which was disposed of actually on summary judgment and not on a motion to dismiss, there was one scheme, again, found, and that was to coerce people to give funds for the sheriff's reelection. Again, disposed of on summary judgment, where the court found that the plaintiff had made no allegations of an ongoing pattern beyond that one scheme. Here, Mr. K has alleged a pattern of conduct to control and manipulate real estate to the personal advantage of certain decision makers. Read most favorably to Mr. K, as is required by Rule 12b-6, his allegations concerning pattern do not fall short to dismiss because a threat of continuing activity is possible. As the Supreme Court found in H.J. Inc. versus Northwestern Bell, this court should also find that a threat of continuing activity might be proven by Mr. K at trial, making dismissal at this very early stage inappropriate. Finally, the district court found that Mr. K should have known that a RICO enterprise is defined by structure, organization, and duration, and again, was part of the basis for imposing sanctions. Mr. K did attempt to make allegations concerning enterprise, and he did attempt to meet the requirement of pleading structure. He may have fallen short. His allegations may be somewhat confusing. The district court did not find that he could not correct those deficiencies on amendment. The district court did not find that there was no possible way he could plead enterprise. Just his complaint as is failed to do so.
Dykemer, you've been focusing pretty heavily on sanctions. What's your view on the attorney's fees?
Well, sanctions do relate to the attorney's fees in that the district court ordered Mr. K to pay attorney's fees.
Well, I'm assuming whatever is going to transpire there is attorney's fees plus sanctions. Isn't that what's envisioned by the district court?
I believe the district court's order imposing sanctions specifically states that the sanctions are
just the attorney's fees.
Just the attorney's fees.
Well, what about that? His responsibility as a lawyer to exercise diligence in the draft. I understand the argument about amendment might cure, but how do we reach the abuse of discretion standard of action on a clearly insufficient.
Mr. Kay is, in fact, an attorney, and so the standard is, we acknowledge, different than a regular, normal, pro se attorney. This Court has held that abuse of discretion does not mean, in the case of sanctions, complete deference to the district court. The district court still needs to have a basis for that sanction, those sanctions. And the district court's basis for the sanctions was that Mr. Kay's complaint failed to state a claim. It goes against the policy, the federal policy of freely allowing amendment to state, to sanction a plaintiff for his very first complaint.
We should set aside his standing as an attorney and a member of the... In our consideration of this issue, you want us to set aside his standing as an attorney and a member of the...
We have not argued that.
How should we look at that?
We acknowledge that case law states that pro se plaintiffs who are attorneys should be held to the attorney standard, although a court should consider that someone, even though an attorney as a plaintiff is very emotionally involved in a case like this, and maybe those kind of factors should be taken into consideration.
Well, would we sanction an attorney for the other side that sought sanctions in a case like this? Frivolous to have sought sanctions if it wasn't imposed by the judge but was sought by opposing party?
I think that's a viable option.
So if that's a viable option, I'm just trying to see how we reach discretion that's viable to a district.
This court has overturned sanctions before.
I understand that.
And the abuse of discretion is found in the fact that the sanctions were imposed based on the very first complaint, despite making absolutely no finding that complaint could not be amended to state a potentially valid claim.
We wouldn't make that requirement, though, would you, of a district court that ever impose attorney's fees if there's the potential to successfully amend? Should that be the standard?
On a first complaint, it's not a bad standard to start with.
Wouldn't that really just gut Rule 11? Rule 11 says you have to do your research before filing. The proposition that you can never sanction the first complaint but have to wait for a second one says, well, forget about all that research before filing. Just do your research between the first and the second complaints.
The purpose of sanctions is to give attorneys a reason not to do that. By having that rule, I mean, an attorney is not going to file a first complaint knowing, well, I can just amend it. It doesn't matter.
You'd be surprised.
Well, there typically wouldn't be necessarily a very good reason to do that. Particularly,
well, yeah, you can think of reasons that attorneys will view as good. They're lazy. They don't get it done till the statute of limitations is about to expire. And they say, oh, well, I'll just file this and I'll do the work later. I'll get it amended.
Well, that would be a subjective bad faith, which this court did not find. The federal policy is to allow freedom to amend. And if district courts can sanction a plaintiff for filing a first complaint that can be amended, that certainly goes against that policy. Because
it sounds like your argument is just saying you don't have to do research before filing. It's enough to do research after filing. And that's inconsistent with the whole project of Rule 11, which... Before you initiate the litigation, you have to have done the work.
I think Mr. Kay's complaint reflects that he did do research. I mean, he attempted to plead under the RICO statute. He attempted to plead the elements. He may have failed. Just failing, everybody who gets a complaint dismissed on a motion to dismiss, objectively, yes, that complaint fails. That doesn't mean it requires Rule 11 sanctions.
Let me ask you one more question. Again, as amicus, you may not be in a position to answer this. But did anybody argue in the district court that attorney's fees are not the right measure of the sanction? They were the normal sanction before Rule 11 was amended in 1993. The 1993 amendment says that awards are, and I quote, limited to what is sufficient to deter repetition, close quote. And the committee note accompanying that says that means that attorney's fees should not be the normal sanction. Was that ever raised in the district court?
I don't believe it was raised in the district court. It raises a good point, though, that maybe sanctioning someone for the entire defendant's attorney's fees.
Of course, it wasn't, as it happens, it wasn't raised in this court. Mr. Kay may have done some legal research, but research into the history of it. Thank you very much, Ms. Eichenberry. Mr. Ronsky.
Good morning. I'd like to turn to the issue of sanctions as well, I think, because I believe that the underlying judgment is very clearly final.
We do need to start with appellate jurisdiction. Ms. Eichenberry made that the first question in her brief.
All right, Your Honor.
The big question is, assume the district court entered this obviously defective judgment. I don't know why you didn't ask him to correct Rule 58 judgment. Put that to one side. The district court enters this defective judgment, and it's the rule that if we're really confident that the case is over, then we we're not really confident it's over. How can we be really confident that the case is over?
I think that confidence stems from the judge's opinion, which did two things. Number one, it dismissed the complaint. And number two, it granted the defendant's motions for sanctions in their entirety. And the motion for sanctions expressly included a request that leave to amend be denied. And that by granting those two, by issuing those two orders.
But did the district court ever enter an order denying leave to amend?
Not in those words.
See, that's part of the problem, right? The defendants say, please make it clear that amendment is not allowed. And the district judge doesn't do that. Well, one ordinary inference is that amendment is allowed. It's hard to be really confident that the district judge thought it was over if the defendant asks for that, and the judge doesn't do it. Is that a problem?
From a practical purpose of administration, Your Honor, I would admit that is a problem, and that the Rule 58 judgment in this case is clearly defective. But as a matter of jurisdiction, Your Honor, I don't think it's a problem, because I think the Bankers Trust versus Miles case says
where it's clear that the case is over, you can appeal. That's fine. I'm just asking the question. How can it be clear that the case is over when district court has never said you can't appeal, and the defendant asked the district court to say that, and he didn't? You know, obviously, Malice is a very different case. It was clearly over in Malice. Here we're just trying to figure out whether it was clearly over.
I understand, Your Honor, and I think that that question presumes that the only way it can be clear under Malice is if the judge says in the order the particular words, leave to amend, is denied. And I would submit to you that here, where there is a sanctions motion requesting that relief, and that sanctions motion is granted in its entirety, that it's equally clear. The judge didn't use those words, I'll concede that, but what he did was the effective equivalent of that, and makes the result and his intent to be done with this case, save for calculating the award of the monetary sanction, which under Kokomo II itself doesn't create a jurisdictional issue. I submit that it is final, and it is clear enough for Malice.
So the case would stand for, if you grant a motion for attorney, don't say anything more. That motion is granted. I mean, this case.
I don't think so, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your question correctly. I think the
How could it be? Because under Rule 11, you can be sanctioned for failing to do research, even if you're completely entitled to amend. Right? If you file a slapdash complaint not having done any research, you violated Rule 11, you have to pay sanctions, whatever they are, even if you're then entitled to amend and go on with the case.
That's true, Your Honor. And what I would say the rule is that in a case where a sanctions award is granted, but the particular relief sought by the party seeking sanctions expressly included denial of leave to amend, and that motion is granted, that is sufficiently clear to get within the malice rule or the exception to needing a standalone
competent. But you asked, did you not, Mr. Ronsky, for A and B. And the judge says you get A and we have to assume B, right?
Well, the judge said you get both, and I just don't know how much attorney's fees you're getting, but I'll give you fees. Please submit your what you want, and I'll review it, presumably.
Well, you asked for sanctions and an order barring amendment, right. And you got sanctions.
We asked for an order barring amendment as a sanction. We asked for attorney's fees as a sanction. The district court has broad discretion in determining what type of sanction it should be issued, and I don't disagree.
I don't think Christopher does either, but it's just, how do we know they granted everything you asked for?
I would say because the order says he did, that he granted our motion for sanctions, and he didn't decide
Suppose your motion had said, what we want is sanctions and $1 million cash immediately. The district judge says, I grant your award for sanctions, period. Are you entitled to $1 million in cash immediately?
I'd say it's a matter of interpretation, not intuitively, Your Honor. It's possible that that's what the judge intended. But here I just think it is clear.
Suppose you say what we want is sanctions and an injunction against ever filing further litigation. The district court says, I grant your request and you're entitled to sanctions, period. But you get does that mean that an injunction has been entered? Yeah, I hope you can see the problem.
I do see the problem, Your Honor. I hope you can see what I'm trying to say, and if I'm not being clear, I apologize. We didn't ask for sanctions and denial of leave to amend. We asked for sanctions consisting of A, denial of leave to amend, and B, an award of reasonable attorney's fees. And so I submit that in granting sanctions, the way that our motion was phrased and the way that the district court's order is written, sanctions included clearly denial of leave to amend. And obviously, the malice standard is fact-dependent on what the orders look like and what the underlying pleadings look like. That's clear, and I'm submitting that in this case, that standard is satisfied based on the procedural history of what went on below.
Well, you're not making a frivolous argument. You may even be making a reasonable argument, but are we sure it's a definitive one? Because that's a pretty strong separate sanction. Can't go any further in this court with this proposed for pay the cost of bringing us to court.
Well, if
you make one clear,
if we want to talk about whether that's an abuse of discretion, we can talk about that as well, because I think that's what you're.
No, I'm not going to the area of discretion right now. I'm just talking about the area of how clear. Can't really view the discretion until we know what doing, it seems.
I understand, Judge, and I agree with you. If we had just asked for Rule 11 sanctions and Judge Stadtmuller, you figure out what they are, and he says, I grant you sanctions,
that wouldn't
satisfy the test. The point is we asked for a...
That wouldn't preclude an amendment.
It would not preclude an amendment, and it wouldn't fall within malice if we tried to argue that it did preclude an amendment. But that's not what happened here. We asked for a specific sanction, and I don't think there's anything below to indicate that we didn't get it. All the indications are that we got the sanctions that we requested. And clearly Rule 11 contemplates non-monetary sanctions like this, and then we get to the substantive issue, which is wasn't an abuse of discretion.
I think if there wasn't a potential for a salvageable complaint here, your argument would even greater force, carry. I'm not so sure we have that situation now to the point of abuse of discretion. The judge gave the attorney's fees and said you factual underpinnings could never be. And I'm not sure we have that in this case, that's all.
Fair enough, Judge. I think we do have this case here for a lot of reasons, but the main reason being that Kay did not, and the facts of the complaint cannot be consistently alleged to plead a pattern of racketeering activity. Yes?
If the plaintiff has a right to amend once as of unless particular documents have been filed. A motion for summary judgment, for example, cuts off that right. Has any of the documents cutting off the right to file to amend once as of course?
Well, I think there's a judgment that has been entered, and that the judgment then triggers Rule 59 and Rule 60, and it cuts off the Rule 15A ability to amend once as a matter of course.
No, actually, an order of the district court dismissing a complaint doesn't cut off the right to amend.
I understand that, Judge, and then we're back to the argument of what is the stub and substance.
You're not asking my question. You're not answering my question. Under the rules, there are certain documents that a defendant may file that cut off the plaintiff's right. Of course, has the defendant filed any of those documents?
Has the defendant filed any of those documents? We've not filed any documents with the district court, Your Honor, since filing our declarations in support of our motions for attorney's fees or our request for particular attorney's fees. So I want to move then, I guess, to whether this complaint was salvageable. And as I said, I don't think it was for two reasons, the main one, though, being that there's no pattern of racketeering here. The Gamboa case and the H.J. case and the Roger Whitmore's Auto Services case make clear that there has to be a threat of continuing criminal activity. And that can be shown in two ways. One is through a concept called closed-ended continuity, which requires a lot of predicate acts over a prolonged period of time. Here, even if we give precedence to all the alleged predicate acts, and I think there were a lot of pleading deficiencies in them, they don't all qualify, but let's assume that away for the minute. There's just a handful of unrelated predicate acts over a period of really no more than a year. And if you look at this court's RICO precedents, that's just insufficient as a matter of law. So then we turn to open-ended continuity. Well, there we have to start with the fact that Judge Stadtmuller found that Kay forfeited that issue below by not arguing.
Can I ask, sorry to take you back. Let me ask my question in a way that's more convenient.
Yes, sir.
Did you file a motion to dismiss only, or did you also file an answer?
We only filed a motion to dismiss.
Now, you have not cut off the right to. Filing an answer would cut it off. Filing a motion to dismiss does.
That's correct. I did misunderstand your question,
okay.
Your Honor.
And thank you.
I understand. So we have to look at open-ended continuity, which requires facts that show in and of themselves that there's a threat that this is going to continue. And not only is that not in the complaint, but I submit the complaint forecloses that. One of the persons alleged to be the main actor using her governmental authority as a member of one of these city commissions was no longer even on the commission at the time that this was filed, and that's expressly alleged in the complaint. There's nothing here that shows this is anything other than your single-shot case. There's at best, a deal between these real estate commissioners to swap these properties that is done over and closed. And that is, by definition, not a pattern of racketeering activity. It may be actionable under something else. It's not actionable under RICO. The enterprise allegations are the second reason that this complaint is not salvageable, because they're totally incoherent, and there are no facts in here that could plead an enterprise consistent with the complaint. Now, Amicus wants to say, well, maybe the Department of City Development could be the complaint. There's a couple problems with that, the first one being that in the complaint case says it's not the enterprise. But Amicus, as Your Honors have recognized, is in a delicate position. It doesn't know what facts can be alleged. It's not going to be there if this case went back to the district court. We have to assume that the facts that exist are the ones that are pleaded in the complaint. And I think if you look at what's there now, particularly given the Twombly standard, it's not just whether this is possible. It's whether we can have a plausible suggestion that Mr. Kay is entitled to relief. He can't satisfy the pattern or the enterprise questions, and that can't be cured through amendment, not consistent with the allegations of the complaint. He's told us what the facts are. We look at those facts. Those facts are not a pattern. Those facts are not a RICO enterprise. And I think when Judge Stadtmuller found that, he also found that the allegations of pattern and enterprise were objectively frivolous. And what we really have here from a monetary standpoint is unnecessary cost shifting. Mr. Kay is a lawyer, so he got to basically put all these costs of responding to this complaint on the defendants for the cost of a filing fee. The TCI case, the Classic Components case, they show that that Rule 11 is supposed to remedy that. It's supposed to shift those costs back to the party who should have incurred them in the first instance, giving credence to the American rule that every party should bear their own attorney's fees. Mr. Case sued everybody from the mayor of the city of Milwaukee to a retired librarian, and he's imposed a lot of costs and a lot of angst, and I think the district court, seeing that this was objectively frivolous, yes, who was one of the members of this neighborhood association, the East Village Association.
Not sued as a librarian.
No, but
Lisa,
my point is these are...
A little more color than, you know, I once checked a book out of the library.
Okay. But the point is to put the fees where they ought to be, and that's why I think the monetary sanction as well as leave to demand was appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ronsky. Anything further, Ms. Eikenberry?
About 30 seconds for rebuttal, so I'll make it quick. The defendants argued the Bankers Trust v. Malice case. I think if you look at that case, the actual Supreme Court holding was relating to whether or not the separate judgment requirement was something that the parties could waive, and held that, yes, they can waive that. This is a different case. This does not involve the separate judgment. It involves whether or not a decision is final and appealable, and whether or not Mr. K still maintains that right to amend his complaint. In the event it is not final and appealable. I think case law is clear that when a court grants a motion to dismiss.
I hate to, one more question, but if the only reason that the judgment was not final is that it might have been admitted to amend, the fact that A never tried to amend in the district court cut off that right, can't wait forever to amend. We actually heard in this very courtroom a case called Otis against the City of Chicago, where the district court gave the plaintiff some time to amend, and the plaintiff didn't do it. The question is whether the judgment became final when the time expired. Yes. Maybe this case is in that box. If the plaintiff just never tried to amend, and it would be too late now.
I would agree that this case might be in that box if the court had, in fact, said you have until such and such a date to amend, and Mr. K had not taken that opportunity. That was not the district court's decision. And by telling Mr. K that he needed to go back to that district court who had already granted significant sanctions against him, I think that is a potential requirement that shouldn't necessarily apply in this situation given the early part of this case.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Eikenberry, and we appreciate your willingness and that of your firm to file an amicus brief in this case. You've been very helpful to the court, and you have our great appreciation. The case is taken under advisement.